Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and get a $25 service credit or device discount.
If he hasn't made you mad yet, he will. He's Dan Carlin, and this is Common Sense.
I couldn't help but think of one overriding question before I came in the studio today. And, you know, I'm obviously losing my mind right now over the Hardcore History Challenge, the current challenge du jour. Just when I think I've learned my lesson about picking these enormous topics to try to wade through, and then I always get sort of deep in the quicksand in the middle, whether it's the fall of the Roman Republic or, you know, the history of Mongol conquest or whatever it is. Never have I challenged myself like this and never been in more danger of failing, I'll tell you that. So my apologies that the show's so late, as usual. If it keeps up, we're going to have to change the description of this from a current events show to a recent history show. And hopefully we can at least stay with recent history. Several things fill up the recent history book since the last time we spoke. I want to get into a couple of them, and I don't know how much. Like, there's one that I just want to mention for a minute. There's another that's sort of something we've talked about not that long ago, but it's a problem that got more intense since the last time we spoke. And then there's the one that as a person, and, you know, I say this all the time because I feel like it's shorthand and it explains what I mean and you understand it. As a person who believes in the myths of America, and, you know, there's a traditional combination of qualities that goes into the traditional mythical American. Is that a good way to put it? Our ideal of ourselves. And when we pick examples of people, I've always picked my grandfather as people that exemplify what this country is supposed to be to you. There's a couple of qualities they seem to combine. And one is a sort of a rugged, common sense toughness, which goes back to your Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Andrew Jackson. I mean, all these guys that just, you know, this is a frontier country with people that were then cowboys. I mean, they're just, you know, Australia, I think, has it. I think these places where there's just a long tradition of individualism and rugged, you know, I'll throw in all the myths. But I think that there are people who try to live up to myths. They create the standard by which we measure ourselves, sometimes a bar to reach for. That's why the myths of America are important. It helps anchor us at least a little bit to what we think we are, so that when we look in the mirror, there's some reflection that we recognize. But the other quality these Americans have is idealism. And remember, idealism is not, you know, it's a funny combination with people who are realists. To be a realist and an idealist is a strange mix. You know, it's a peanut butter chocolate kind of thing, or maybe oil and vinegar, but it works. Like Woodrow Wilson said something like, yes, I'm an idealist, I'm an American. And the two kind of go together. But the idealism, as I said, is sometimes at odds with the realism. But it's what keeps us who we... I mean, if you just become a realist, there's tons of negative historical examples, at least from an American perspective, that you would not want to emulate, that involves people who are working on purely realistic calculations. It's the idealistic part that keeps us from becoming sometimes, if the arguments seem to support it, the Gestapo. I'm listening to a bunch of people in the wake, and this is what brought this up, the wake of the release, the famous now release, this huge release, we're told, of almost 600 pages of executive summary of a greater 6,000 pages looking into CIA torture activities after 9/11, and watching Republicans and Democrats, and seeing how the whole executive summary is sort of organized. It's organized to do this same thing. They're having a legitimate, in their own minds, debate over the effectiveness of the torture. That's a Gestapo argument. And I don't, and there's a part of me that I can't get my mind around the unreality surrounding it. Now you guys know this. I'm not rational, and I've said this before. You need to see old shows, and you want to hear detailed examinations of my lack of reality when it comes to certain issues like torture. Ben, if there is a Ben, went back and picked out a couple of shows just almost off the top of his head because they were, you know, whenever we do one show and then the very next show is about the same subject, it's because the first show elicited such a response that I felt the need to then address it again. We did show number 125. It was called Mad About Torture, and I angered enough people in what we thought was a big audience then. Now it looks minuscule. That I did show number 126, The Way You Play the Game. And 126, I believe, Ben said it's one of those ones where you're mad at the entire audience. And we do those sometimes. I mean, that was my whole radio career. That was my whole radio career, was me against the audience. Most of the time, though, you folks aren't that way. But, you know, you're thinkers. And when you hear me say something you disagree with, you take offense. And we can go at it sometimes. Sometimes you go at me for my idealistic side. But I consider that a part of, you know, what makes a good American. It's what keeps us from having arguments like, listen, the only thing that makes torture bad is you don't get good information sometimes. If you could figure out a way to make sure you only got good information, there's nothing wrong with torture. Look at all the people that knew what they were doing that signed on to torture. I mean, the Gestapo, bad guys, knew what they were doing. I mean, that's where the argument tends to go too quickly for me. The first question I always have with these kinds of things, and I think it's indicative right there, of bringing us back down to reminding us what we're talking about. It's very easy to enhanced interrogation. You throw a bunch of different words out there to color, you know, what we mean here. The first thing I want to know is, if you decide, if you are the people in government after 9/11 that decide we're going to take the gloves off, and taking the gloves off means we're going to go medieval on their ass, where do you go for the actual guys on the ground that do that? I mean, if you need a medieval torturer or their modern-day functional equivalent, you know, do you open up the yellow pages? Do you, you know, get on Google? How do you find these people? Do you scour the jails? Remember, the Nazis, little-known fact for those who don't delve into this, but the Nazis were pretty good at going out and dragging occupied territories to find the kind of people they thought could do these jobs for them. They'd go empty out a prison and grab a bunch of convicts and load them up with alcohol and tell them to shoot a bunch of Jews in a pit, because most people don't take to shooting a bunch of people in a pit very easily. Where do you go to find torturers after 9/11 if you decide you need them? And, you know, one of the things this report that came out the other day supposedly said was that CIA agents who had to conduct these operations on detainees sometimes would be crying and upset and asked for the torture to stop. And their higher ups would say, you know, keep doing it. That's always encouraging, isn't it? That's nice. And for those who say it wasn't torture, I really doubt the CIA agents are crying and begging their superiors to stop if it's not. One of the things that I think has been proven pretty conclusively for those people who'll say things like, listen, you know, waterboarding, it's not comfortable, but it's not torture. Ask anybody who's been waterboarded. Several pundits decided after 9/11 to act real big and show that it wasn't torture, and most of them didn't last 15 seconds, and every one of them got up and said it was torture. Nobody got up and said, no, that wasn't torture. To his credit, and I disagree with him about a ton of things, he's one of these people I think should be gone, one of these old-timers who's doing nobody any good, and I don't even understand how the people in his own home state keep reelecting him. I assume it must have something to do with gerrymandering. John McCain, who was tortured in North Vietnam, he was a pilot shot down, and he was tortured. He has never wavered from his opinion that it's just wrong on so many levels. I have a quote from him. It's worth reading because, you know, torture is one of those things that, as I said, defies rational calculation. This is not getting a bunch of smart men and women in a room and sort of debating the efficacy of these things, despite what you're hearing from our legislators who are. This is an issue that crosses certain boundaries. And, you know, I'm a guy who prides himself on seeing nuance and shades of gray. And I realize that there's different perspectives and all these, but there are, that doesn't mean there's not black and white. I see black and white too. I just don't see it as much as a lot of people out there. The black and white is on certain things that separate us from the bad guys. And I was raised this way, as was every other American, by the way, during the Cold War. We were raised that there were certain things Americans just didn't do. No ifs, ands, or buts. And you could tell who the good guys and the bad guys were in a story based on if they had crossed these. You know, these are like biblical commandments. There is no, oh, we eased over the line and didn't notice it. They're lines in the sand. Torture's one of them. Americans don't torture. That's what separated us from the Nazis. That's what separated us from the communists. It's what kept the little flame of American exceptionalism alive. Here's the John McCain quote, by the way, because when people say these things, they deserve to be repeated. And as much as I'm going to slam John McCain from pillar to post regularly, when he says something like this, he deserves to be lauded for it. He's a man who should know. He said, quote, I understand the reasons that governed the decision to resort to these interrogation methods, and I know that those who approved of them and those who used them were dedicated to securing justice for the victims of terrorist attacks and to protecting Americans from further harm. But I dispute wholeheartedly that it was right for them to use these methods, which this report makes clear were neither in the best interest of justice, nor our security, nor the ideals we have sacrificed so much blood and treasure to defend. End quote. And, you know, that's an interesting way to look at it, because so many of these people, the people that make my brain seize up and just lock, the ones that I can't compute, are the super patriots out there. And the funny thing is that in my own mind, I'm a super patriot, but I'm not like any of these super patriots who go around making a living off being a super patriot. Watching some of these super patriots, the same people who their sign off to people who agree with them is sometimes words like, "You're a great American," that they're able to both embrace this wonderful exceptionalism of America and our ideals and our history and our values and all that stuff, and embrace torture too. I don't understand. I mean, what does your IQ have to be to understand that those two things don't go together? And never have. To me, that's Orwellian, when you can take the ideals of America and equate them somehow with torture and blend them and have somebody drink it and go, that was good. If you could go back in a time machine to my grandfather's day and tell him we're torturing people, he would tell you it wasn't America anymore. And this is the funny thing about the difference between the two sides of the traditional American that we spoke about, the one that could be this rugged, do whatever needs to be done, frontier sort of mentality with that idealism that comes with it. I'll give you an example. Now, I've talked about my grandfather before. I don't want to go into how he's Batman and all that again. But he embodied, and as I said, I use him as my example, those two almost oil and watery type things together, the idealist and the realist. If you had told my grandfather, and he knew all this anyway, that on the Pacific battlefields, in the Pacific War and the Second World War, the United States soldiers would often go onto the battlefield after the fighting was over and shoot the wounded Japanese on the battlefield, which, by the way, the Japanese did too. It was a horrible, merciless war. My grandfather would have given you some speech about how sometimes, you know, on the ground, decisions have to be made that nobody likes and that are tough decisions, and the people who make them have to live with it the rest of their life. But that's just how it is sometimes. And yet, if you had told him that we were capturing those Japanese that were wounded on the battlefield, patching them up, flying them back to the United States and putting them in a jail and torturing them to find out what they knew about, you know, defenses on the next island we were going to attack or whatnot, he would march on the Capitol, because that would violate American values. There's something different about the idea of an emergency need on the field at a low level and government policy at the highest levels. Another example, the United States soldiers in the Philippine insurrection, which happened around the turn of the last century, so 1900, 1903, right around in there. We talked about it a little bit in one of the hardcore history shows. It is a guerrilla war. It is nasty. American soldiers are dying, and they would sometimes capture Philippine guerrillas, and by the standards we're talking about in this conversation, torture them. There are photos of them waterboarding these captured guerrillas. Now, the people doing the waterboarding are a couple of American soldiers, right? They want to know where the arms catch is hidden. They want to know where the ambush setup is. They want to know if Joe Blow down the street, who's smiling and doing the soldiers' laundry, is really an informer. I mean, they've got reasons, right? And yet that wasn't the national policy of the country. There wasn't some decision at the White House that the United States will decide if we capture any of these poor Filipino guerrillas that we will torture them. There are no torture chambers opened up, you know, that our people are running. It just doesn't exist. There's a difference. Now, the reason that matters is because, you know, and it's something that Antonin Scalia, one of the justices on the Supreme Court, was saying not that long ago when he was speaking and talking about torture. He was talking about the situation that everyone brings up, and I hope I'm not jumping around too much. My brain is just mush from the history show, so I'm going to use that as an out, maybe permanently. But Scalia was talking to the audience, and he was talking about torture, and he was basically saying, yes, it's a terrible thing, but is any of us suggesting, and I think his exact words were, that any jury out there would convict a person who tortured a person who knew of a nuclear bomb that was going to go off in American City in an hour? He said it's a complicated issue. He just summed up, and I'm going to try to maybe take his point across topics to another topic. He just summed up, though, the out that already exists for that. Believe it or not, my grandfathers and the traditional hard-bitten realist frontier get-it-done Americans always had a loophole that allowed for that circumstance to be dealt with. And that's why, you know, it's funny because if you take out the so-called ticking time bomb scenario, all of a sudden the rationales that defend this torture activity begin to evaporate in the sunlight. That's everybody's favorite thing. What if we have a bomb going off and he knows? What if they've kidnapped 20 people and they know where they are? I mean, it's always that kind of thing. The jury not convicting the person, as Antonin Scalia was suggesting, is the loophole. Let me play with that scenario for a second, the ticking time bomb scenario. You are the CIA station head in Miami, and they bring a guy to you that they say they've just caught, and his phone indicates that there's a bomb planted that's going to go off sometime today, and he knows where it is, right? Maybe in the next, I don't know, hour. The ticking time bomb, right? The pressure's on. Not a lot of time. If that CIA station head in Miami takes this guy to the back room and holds a Bic lighter under his foot until he tells you where the bomb is, the loophole for that, folks, there doesn't have to be a law passed secretly in Washington, D.C. to make sure that guy has the ability to do that. If the CIA station head does it against the rules, maybe he goes to trial. And do you know what happens at trial? Exactly what Justice Antonin Scalia said would happen. The jury says, we're not convicting this guy. Anybody would have done that. We're glad he did it. That's sometimes what a man has to do. Sometimes you have to execute the wounded on the battlefield. Sometimes you have to waterboard the, you know, Philippine insurrectionist. That's not a government policy, though. Now, here's the thing. Is that a bit like torture laundering? You know, are we just saying, oh, yes, torture exists, but we have it so that, you know, we're not officially acknowledging it. But, you know, we've been doing that in this country for 100 years. I want to go down a little bit of the history of why this direct torturing of people is such a line in the sand for us. Because, you know, we've been indirectly torturing people for some time now. We mentioned, for example, the waterboarding of Philippine insurrectionists. Okay, that's one level where some low-level person on the ground does something that's against policy, but, you know, it's in the field. You saw this, by the way, in the Vietnam War. It's not uncommon amongst many militaries all over the world, right? During the Cold War, something interesting happened. I always think that, you know, if you want to find the moment where the United States forever changed, I mean, it's the kind of thing I think 500 years from now, historians will easily identify. 1947, 1948, during the Truman administration, is really when the country went into, I'm going to use hyperbolic words now, but you'll know what I mean. If we went from a republic to an empire and we did so in a short period of time, it was 1947, 1948. We made all these changes to deal with the Soviet communism threat, and those changes really solidified the old rules that were already in place and set a foundation for everything we built upon since that changed the country fundamentally. One of the things that changed was the balance between our realism as Americans and our idealism as Americans. And I do think that it is like a balance, right? And at times it gets out of whack. A perfect example of a time it got out of whack, I would suggest, was in the Second World War when we took Japanese Americans and interned them in internment camps because we were afraid there might be spies amongst them or they might be disloyal or whatnot. By the way, if Americans had voted on this, they would have voted to put them in the camps. I always say, you know, you can't even trust the American people on some of this stuff. If you voted after 9/11 to torture people to find out if they were terrorists, I think you could probably get a majority vote there, too, should it become the law of the land. If a majority of Germans decide we should be gassing Jews, is that the right move? That's how you could get a representative government to do horrible things. Just assume that the people are virtuous and will be able to override their fear with their more high-minded sentiments. During the Cold War, and there's a quote, I wish I'd thought about it, and my brain hadn't been so mushy, I would have pulled it out. We've used it before. There was a great quote, I don't remember if it was to Truman or very early Eisenhower administration, but one of the bigwigs over in the national security apparatus had said to the president that, you know, we're facing an implacable enemy with the Soviet Union. You know, they will stop at nothing, essentially. And he was saying, in order to combat a foe like that, we're going to have to be willing to jettison our ideals, you know, our standards, our idealism enough to compete with these people, because otherwise they'll beat us. They'll use every dirty trick that we will deliberately not do because it conflicts with American values to do that, but they'll do it. So the idea was we had to be willing to do horrible stuff that might be un-American in nature because of the threat we faced. And let's be honest, ladies and gentlemen, and you need to keep this in mind. I always try to keep it in mind, too. No matter how much they try to scare you about these terrorists, they are nothing, nothing compared to the Soviet threat we dealt with in the Cold War. And you need to understand that, because when they start talking about things that we wouldn't have even done during the Cold War, that would have seemed too much back then to deal with a threat that could literally destroy life on Earth, remember that the threat we're facing now is a gnat compared to that, okay? Even in the worst case scenario. Nonetheless, what we started doing as a country was, and this is where I think we went off the rails. This is where, when I was a protester in college, I mean, these are the kind of things I protested, was where our country did things that violated their values, their stated values. We violated the American marketing slogans. And some of us think that that's wrong. When we cozy up to governments that are not only not supported by their people, but treat their people the way really bad governments treat their people. I don't want to say Nazis because you play with Godwin's law, but you know what I'm saying. When you're the government of El Salvador or a lot of other Central American or Middle Eastern governments who tortures and does terrible things to their own people, and their own people would get rid of them if they could, but you stay in power in part because the United States supports you, because you're helping us in this Cold War, this existential threat. Those are the kind of things which, by the way, plant the seeds for long-term problems, because people start hating you. And they hate you because your activities are conflicting with your marketing slogans, too. There's a lot of people in the Middle East now that are living with a whole lot of extremism who got angry initially at us in the United States because we would talk one thing and do another. And they had to live under regimes that only stayed in power because we helped them. And when they stayed in power, they did things like, oh, I don't know, roast people who were in jail over the wire frames of cots. That was the Shah of Iran. We overthrew the elected Iranian government that came to power before him. And then in 79, they overthrew the Shah. And who do you think they were angry with? That's right. The people that did something that clashed so much with their, you know, ideals, right? Realism had trumped idealism, and we're still paying the price for that. In my opinion, it's why when you get something out of balance between your realism and idealism scale, it can come back to haunt you. The realists love to point out the bad things that can happen if you're not realistic enough. But believe it or not, the idealistic stuff solves problems too. If you'd been more idealistic when Mohammad Mossadegh comes to power in Iran in the 1950s, treated it more like, well, you know, this is democracy in action and that's what America supports and whatnot, you might not have any of this stuff relating to the Iranian Revolution in 79 or anything now. Now, that's 2020 hindsight kind of stuff, but I would argue that the more we err on the side of realism, on the realism-idealism scale, the less like America we become and the more the rest of the world sees through the marketing slogans. When you can say, you're a great American and this country's the shining city on the hill and we're the exceptional nation and all these kinds of things, and we should be torturing and it's a good thing, I'm sorry, there's a lot of people that are going to see that as hypocritical if you're still buying the marketing. If the marketing stuff is anything more than just for show, right? There's an old shirt that people wear. It's a real patriotic shirt and it shows the American flag and the line underneath says, these colors don't run. Yes, they do. They run if they get scared enough, and that's what happens when you don't live up to your ideals. You open yourself up to charges of moral cowardness. And that's what the torture thing is. Where do you get people to do this? Where do you find the great Americans who'll do the torturing for you? And for those of you, by the way, who have no problem with the, Dan, who just had to be realist, this terrorism threat is like nothing we've ever faced before, I'll hit you in a different place. Do you know we paid two guys, apparently, two psychologist-type guys, $80 million for their help in this torture situation? Did I get that right, Ben? It was two guys, right? Two psychologists. What did they do? Split it down the middle? Did we give them stock options? I mean, okay, there's your government right there. Can't even run a torture operation without going over budget and giving away to the special interest. Who are the special interests in a torture thing, Ben? Is it the people that make, like, car batteries or chains or waterboarding equipment? Here's the thing, folks. one of two things is going to happen 30, 40, 50 years from now over all this torturing. And I don't know which one's worse. Either we're going to look back on this era, this torturing that so many in our government right now and our CIA are defending, you know, and understand the way they're defending it. You know, their lines were crossed, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, America was kept safe, or these are real patriotic people, or whatever you want to say. Either we're going to look back on the torturing from the early 2000s as one of the worst periods, one of the blackest marks in American history, or we're not. And if we don't look at it as one of the blackest marks in American history, that's almost worse. And the reason you need to understand that this is kabuki theater, you know, and that this doesn't matter. I mean, the reason I'm not talking about real reforms and the investigation and the specifics and all that stuff, the specifics you should have known. I saw 30 stories on this torture report. I didn't see anything that I didn't in my heart know what was going on already. I think it was clear from whistleblowers and other sources and leaks. And I mean, if you're reading magazine stories, and you would know that most of this stuff, or assume most of this stuff, was happening. I didn't find any of the revelations shocking. I think some good things have come out of it. I should say that this entire Senate oversight, so the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee looking into this ended up having, and it was an unexpected, I should say, it was an, let me back up, mush brain here. The best thing that might have come out of this torture report, because the president is selling this as though simply releasing this executive summary of a 6,000-page report has solved the problem. This is why this is kabuki theater. By telling the world what we did, we have somehow confessed our sins, and we will be forgiven, and this will be a dark era in the past, as some of these people have said, and it's over with now, never to be repeated again. But folks, there's nothing in here, nothing, that either prevents this from happening again, nor is there even agreement that it was wrong to have done in the first place. If you can't even get a consensus out there that this was the wrong thing to do, how on earth is anybody 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now going to feel impeded by this at all? They're not going to turn around and say, well, look what happened the last time we tried to torture anybody. They're going to say nobody even agreed. Some Democrats got out there and said that, you know, and John McCain, a few people. Nobody cared. We can get away with this. And nobody goes to jail and nobody gets investigated. The most upsetting thing about Barack Obama as a president, and it makes me sick. I'm sorry, folks. But you know, bad leadership when your country is in such trouble I find it hard to forgive people for this. And everybody wants you to forgive the person who's from their party. Well, look at what he inherited. Look at the other party and how hard they are to work with. Blah, blah, blah. They ran for the job. They knew the job was dangerous when they took it. They said they were the best guy for the job. This is what we get. This is what we got the last time. This is what we got the time before. I'm tired of these people who are not up to the task. I'm tired of people defending them. And I'm tired of having somebody like the current president, who just did what they all do, running for office in 2008, promising to overturn the bad things his, you know, predecessor did, and then getting into power and doubling down on them. He's better than Bush. Is he better than Bush? Really? Prosecuted more whistleblowers, gone after more whistleblowers than all the presidents put together. He's not torturing anybody, Dan. How do you know? This is not a president out there, that none of them are, telling you what's going on behind the scenes. You know what we still do? This is another legacy of our wonderful Cold War. And nobody talks about this. You want to stop the worst thing the United States does in terms of torture? This isn't it. So when President Bush or President Obama says, we don't torture, do you know what they mean, folks? They mean we don't torture directly like we started doing after 9/11. We tortured indirectly before then. You know, I talked about how the Cold War changed everything, and we started supporting these regimes that were evil regimes, but they were our buddies, right? If you're anti-Soviet and our buddy, we'll overlook a lot, right? We'll overlook the fact you torture your own citizens. And sometimes, if we need people tortured, we'll remember your name and put it in the Rolodex. Folks, there's a program, and sometimes it's just called rendition. Sometimes it's called extraordinary rendition. We've been doing this since the 1950s for sure. I would bet in the 1940s as well. And this is true torture laundering. This is how you, if you are a country with an idealistic edge, manage to live with yourself. This is how denial works. do Americans torture? When you ask my grandfather in 1950, my grandfather would say, no, Americans don't torture. And then if he lived long enough, he would get to find out that we would fly people to these countries where we needed torturing done and let them torture them. Or we would train the torturers. Do you know how many people in these horrible countries that we supported that did horrible things to their own people that we trained to do those horrible things to their own people? There are CIA agents in the 80s that are standing right next to the Central American torturers who are torturing people. And just in case any information comes out we can use, they're there to record it and send it on. But the U.S. didn't torture directly. When I was marching in the 80s, you know, we all go through our really angry period, or at least I hope all of us do. I think it's a good step. I'm not as angry as I used to be because I'm old and tired and I got a history show that's not out yet. But, you know, sometimes enough caffeine can conjure up that old anger. And when you talk about supporting evil and with my tax dollars, right, you somehow take my morality and drag it in the mud as somebody who puts up with it. And the idea that we were supporting, I mean, the stories would come out. I'm sorry, I'm all over the place, but I'm just thinking, oh, even now, I'm thinking back to these stories that would come out and, you know, some magazine, a Time or a Life or something would interview a few survivors from these torture chambers in one of these countries. And they would talk about their ordeal and you would find out that somehow the U.S. was connected to what happened. And you would just sit there and you'd want to throw up. It wasn't enough plausible deniability in the torture laundering scheme to keep me from wanting to vomit. President Clinton did this stuff quite a bit, by the way, for those who think it maybe just started with the war on terror. The nastiest thing we did to detainees since 9/11 by far wasn't waterboarding them ourselves or making them stand on broken ankles or rectally feeding them or any of that stuff. The nastiest stuff we did to detainees in the war on terror was send them somewhere else. We sent detainees to Egypt. We sent them to Syria. We sent them to these countries where they did monstrous things to them. And they never would have been there if we hadn't sent them there. That's the nastiest stuff we do to people. And we do it for the exact same reason, right? Because the realist side of us tells us we're in a war of survival here. We're dealing with pure evil that could kill millions of people. You're darn right. What did Dick Cheney say? Do it again. That's fine. A bunch of Republicans and a couple Democrats, I think it was, stood up and said, you know, this torture stuff worked. The Gestapo thought so too. President Obama's job was to make President Bush's administration an anomaly. And we told you this a million times. You've heard me say it. I'm sorry if we keep sounding like a broken record. But sometimes you get administrations that go off in a different direction, and sometimes for very understandable reasons. 9/11 was going to be an absolutely, you know, game-changing moment, no matter who was president. Don't kid yourself. You know, you get hit with something like that, you're insane for a while. The question is, can you right the ship after that insanity moment, right? How long does it take for you to get your sensibilities back, right? If you're interning Japanese Americans because it's the middle of the Second World War and you're freaking out, how long until you turn around and go, we need to let these people go? What were we thinking? Now, I didn't hold the Bush administration accountable for freaking out after 9/11. I think that I would have hoped that they wouldn't, but I think anybody would have. But I held them accountable for sticking by, you know, the legislating while insane long after the blood had cooled. And the Obama administration, this is a guy who ran specifically, and I think I'm quoting here, to overturn the overreaches of the Bush administration. And then he doubles down. Instead of being an anomaly, which it should have been, the Bush administration became the course change that we have lived with ever since. And it affects everything from your local police on the beat in your town, to the soldier fighting in Afghanistan, to the people taking off their belts and shoes at the airport, to having all of your stuff listened to and stored by the government. I mean, folks, I am not sure that there has ever been as profound a change in the relationship between Americans and their government as what happened after 9/11. And we would have been well served to have a leader in power or more leaders in the legislature that asked the most important question, which is this trip really necessary? Are we adequately balancing out our ideals with our, you know, realism? How many terror attacks, ladies and gentlemen, would it have been worth for us to suck up instead of doing what we've done to our entire society? I mean, this is how insurance works, right? If you look and you say, we're going to do all these things to our society because of the threat of terrorism, and you stop 15 terrorist attacks that would have killed 12,000 people in 10 years, was all of that effort well spent? Then ask yourself, you know, how many lives you would have to save and how much damage you would have to prevent to have made it all well spent. I just got done with Jim Risen's book. And his book, it does, it's a very common sense thing. We all realize it, but he tries to put together a bunch of examples where he shows you how this increased demand for security after 9/11 has created tons of opportunities out there and bazillions of dollars that can be made by people who can adequately fill needs that have been created because of 9/11. And that creates a dynamic where for all of those people making all that money, and yes, lobbying legislators, it's not in their best interest for us to at any time feel safer. They would probably spin it by saying, let's not let our guard down and be hit again. You know, stay vigilant, whatever it might be. Folks, we're living through a period here that if you wanted to find an analogy, we're living through the 50s again. And instead of being scared of communism and the Soviet Union, we're scared of terrorism. The difference is, of course, that the 50s ended. The assumption on the part of optimists that I talk to is that this period will too. Now, the 50s was like a wave that washed farther up on the beach where the realism overwhelmed the idealism, and when the water level went back down, it never went as far down to where it started. I mean, the country was permanently changed, the balance between idealism and realism permanently altered. We were a more realistic, less idealistic country forever afterwards, even if we had receded from the very worst of the abuses. Best case scenario, that's what happens with the war on terror, right? In 15 years, we don't have another 9/11, and people start to get back to a lower level of security just because we can't afford the levels we're at. It's never going to go back to what it was pre-9/11. In other words, you never get back what you lost. But there's a possibility that it never recedes at all. There's nothing that says the 1950s had to mellow out into détente and some level of normalcy again, and there's no guarantee that we're ever going to go back to any sort of pre-terrorism fear world, because terrorism's never going away. We talked about that before too, right? The danger of the fact that we've essentially militarized society to go after the equivalent of street crime. And I don't mean that the danger is the same, but the threat is. Street crime's never going away. If I just had today, if we didn't have a war on drugs today because we got rid of it last year, and somebody comes around saying, you know what, we need a war on drugs, you're going to go, you're crazy. We've seen how that works. You never win that. It's a boondoggle. You know, you're never going to get rid of drugs, and at the same time, you're going to warp society trying to. That's what the war on terror is, folks. We want full wartime authority. We want to ratchet down these societies like we're in World War III. But it's against something that we can never say, okay, you can relax now. You can get back to normalcy. It's permanent. And as James Risen has said, and as we all know, once you start down a new national path, there are lots of people who benefit from that. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, when you're looking for opportunities and you make the waterboarding equipment and your sales went up because of the war on terror, there's nothing wrong with saying, oh, it's bad for business. I'm going to push for my business to be good. It's all understandable stuff, but it creates a dynamic where once you get on these new roads, they're hard to change course, but a 9/11 will change your national course. It's hard to get off of it. The interests line up to invest in the way things are. And the way things are, folks, is we have a bunch of legislators in Washington, D.C. right now whose only real argument over whether or not the United States is a country that tortures people directly is, does it work or not? I'm a radical on this issue. To me, I don't feel like a lot of people do, where you'll hear people saying, well, you know, the CIA, this is a heroic organization that protects America. I'm a little bit more cutthroat than that. You know, if you have an organization in the country that has proven over and over and over again to do things that mess too much with the idealistic side of what you think your country is, who make mistakes on such a huge basis. I mean, for any number of reasons, if this were a private company, you would have gotten rid of the CIA a long time ago. And if you think that's somehow un-American, there are presidents who contemplated it. There were guys like Eisenhower. You know, Dwight Eisenhower starts looking like a wonderful... I mean, if we could have an Eisenhower back today, there were so many things wrong with Eisenhower, too. Don't let me romanticize him too much. But on certain issues, like being able to adequately weigh the trade-off between idealism and realism, Eisenhower was a really interesting barometer. And as you know, Eisenhower had been a U.S. general in the Second World War, which gave him a unique ability to call BS on certain things. I mean, he was famous for telling the military to shut up and sit down when they wanted stuff he knew they didn't need, because he was in a position to do that. Everybody always says that Eisenhower gets lionized because he gave that military-industrial complex warning in his farewell speech in 1960. But if you actually go read stuff about Eisenhower, he was concerned about that stuff, what he called the garrison state, all throughout his presidency. And worried about, you know, he was a Midwesterner with down-home American values, really much like my grandfather in a lot of respects, very realistic, and yet at the same time, Boy Scout-like in his concern for the mythology of the United States. And that's what's missing. When we get into these eras where we're afraid, where the brutal realists take over, what was it, Dick Cheney was basically, he's a by any means necessary kind of guy. When those people take over is when we more than ever need the idealists who remind us that there are certain things Americans don't do. And the problem for people like that, and I like to consider myself one of them, is if I go out there and say, you know, Americans don't do this, somebody's going to turn around to me and say, yes, we do. I mean, that's, if you want to get away from my idealistic myth of America arguments, let's just deal with a down-home one, a real brutal realist's argument on this subject. And it's the same argument, by the way, we made with drones over whether or not the way we were behaving as a country with drones 5, 6, 7 years ago was the right thing to do. And I said at the time, be careful. Whether you know it or not, we're setting the rules right now for what other countries are going to do with drones, you know, at the point in time when we're not the only country with them. Folks, when you torture people, and when your senators and congressmen have a debate over essentially that the morality rests with its effectiveness, if it's not effective in telling you what you want to know, torture's bad. If it is effective, torture's good. I would love to know what happens if it's kind of effective. But when you make that the benchmark, then you make it the benchmark for everyone else too. What's our country going to say if some other country out there does the exact same thing to one of our people? If China captures an American, perhaps smuggling something, takes them into the back room and treats them like we treated some of the detainees, these evil people, everybody will say, you know, these evil people, except for the ones that were the mistaken identity people, and except for the ones that we apparently arrested that were related to the people we wanted to talk so that we now had some way to pressure them. If the Chinese do this to our people, what do we say? The Chinese are just going to turn around and say, listen, it was very effective. What are we going to say? I mean, there goes this chance to, you know, stand up for what's right. If you haven't lived what's right yourself, you're hypocritical to tell other people how to behave. Finally, I want to answer an argument that I always get when I bring this subject up. This is the two arguments you hear from the realists most of all is the one about you know, the ticking time bomb scenario, which we already addressed. The other one is the what if it's your kid scenario. And the what if it's your kid scenario goes like this. The person who's more realist on this issue will say, Dan, if it was your kid that had been kidnapped, God forbid, and was being held by some monster, and the police capture the monster, and there's a ticking time bomb, if you will, you know, for you to find your kid, and they're not talking, you would do anything to get that person to talk. Don't be a hypocrite, Dan. But there's a difference between Dan, the father looking for his daughter, being willing to do anything, and the state being willing to do anything. And if you say that the state should do whatever that desperate father would do, then you're setting society's standards at the level of an angry, vengeful, homicidal parent. Is that really where you want them to be? Because I tell you, if that's the standard you're setting, you know, kid is kidnapped, do whatever the parent would do to a bad guy to get them back, then you're going to live in Nazi times, because that's what I would do. Do you really want that to be your societal benchmarks? All right, the other thing that I wanted to get into a little, and I hope that wasn't, I think I jumped around a lot in that, and that's because of the history show. When my brain is on that other subject, there's a lot of jumping. Extract what value you can from that last segment, shall we put it that way? The other big story since the last time we spoke has to do with an intensifying of something that was already happening that we talked about in a relatively recent show. In a relatively recent show, we talked about the police shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, and the resulting protest that came from that. If you recall that, it involved a situation where there was a, I always like to call it a he said, she said, about what happened, and an unarmed black, 20 years old, what was he, Ben? Not quite a boy, not too much of a man, but big, 6'4", 300 pounds, something like that, where an unarmed black man is killed by a police officer. And there was a lot of controversy over, you know, was this done when the victim was fighting with the police officer in a car, or did the police officer shoot the victim multiple times when the victim was at a distance with their hands up? There were conflicting witness accounts, all these kinds of things, right? No video. And we dealt with that. I believe we said in the program, if I can actually think back that far, that part of the problem with all of these things is that when the protests break out, they're not always just about that one incident, that oftentimes an incident like the Ferguson shooting is the straw that breaks the camel's back, right? And it just becomes one too many, and people get fed up, and that, boom, all of a sudden they're out in the streets when they weren't out in the streets the last time someone got shot. Since that story, though, that exact situation has happened in other parts of the country. Boom, 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 another African-American encounter with a police officer that leads to an African-American's death. And so you take a situation that had already raised tension levels, and if you buy into my theory, raise them because it's a straw that broke the camel's back situation, and then you add more straw onto that camel's broken back. And you do a couple of things by doing it. You nationalize it. In other words, at some point, I think people were able to say, especially people that didn't think about this stuff very often, that's a problem in that region. This is a Missouri problem, or that part of the country problem, or what have you. And then these other incidents that happened since the last show we did happened in other parts of the country. So it sort of reminds you that, no, this isn't this localized thing, right? Now, some of the things that happened, not all the things that happened, but some of the things that happened include a man named Eric Gardner in New York was selling loose cigarettes in the street corner. Now, the reason that that's illegal, mostly, is because cigarettes are one of the more highly taxed commodities in our country here on a cigarette-by-cigarette basis. And when the guy is selling them on the street corners, the taxes aren't being collected. So it's illegal. So this guy's on the street corner selling these things. The police surround him. You have to go watch the video. I'm not going to be responsible for explaining it perfectly in every respect. But the guy essentially backs away from the officers, and he's saying, you know, stay away from me. I don't want any trouble, but I'm not, you know, resisting arrest, I guess you could officially say was what he was doing. But he wasn't getting physical. He wasn't getting violent. And several times he was saying, please don't touch me. Please, you know, the way any of us would hope. You know, if somebody gave you a little card that said how to behave when police officers are trying to, you know, touch you or whatever, it would say, please tell them to stop. I mean, it was all these kinds of things. And then an officer grabs him from behind in what can only be described as a chokehold, forces him to the ground. He says several times while he's on the ground, I can't breathe, and then dies. Now, there's another incident, too, that goes with this, but let's stay with this one. It reminds me a little of this torture story in the sense that there are arguments that you hear. To me, there's almost an idiot meter, and sometimes you can watch these people declare themselves idiots. Case in point, and we already knew this about Representative Peter King in New York. And, you know, I very rarely go to name calling, but Peter King's an idiot. And I don't know how the people in his district keep electing, but Peter King's line was that the person who's responsible for that black man's death is the black man because he's asthmatic and overweight. And if he wasn't asthmatic and overweight, he wouldn't have died. The other thing he said was that, and this, by the way, has been said by others. So apparently the idiot meter
not just confined to Peter King, but how ludicrous it would have been to pay attention to him saying, "I can't breathe," when Eric Gardner was saying, "I can't breathe." And that phrase, by the way, has become a catchphrase, and people are making T-shirts and NFL players are writing it on their shoes and whatnot. But when Eric Gardner is saying, "I can't breathe," Peter King and others have said that's nonsense, because if you can't breathe, you can't say, "I can't breathe." But the fact that the guy dies right there and then kind of puts the line to the idea that he could breathe. You're probably not going to die if you don't have the man's arm around your neck constricting your ability to breathe, right? And I mean, what did you want him to say? If he's trying to say, "Officer, let me go, you're hurting me," does he have to say exactly the right way he's being hurt? I mean, it's the most stupid argument. And when you hear that, you know that these are people that, I mean, you don't even know what to say. You want to have a conversation amongst intelligent people who disagree on the merits of the, and, you know, have a good, I don't even know. It's like my brain seizes up, just like, you know, you're a great American and Americans are fine with torture. I mean, I can't deal with those kinds of dichotomies. They're wrong. They're unrelated. They don't make sense. And it's an IQ test to me. Nonetheless, the Eric Gardner thing also made people angry for a very similar reason that the Ferguson thing did. It had to do with society's response. I was in L.A. I've said this before, during the Rodney King riots. I was there when Rodney King was beaten by police officers. I was outside the courtroom multiple times, because there were multiple court-related cases. I was outside the Simi Valley courtroom when officers were acquitted and the city exploded. The problem oftentimes in these cases is not the incident. Oftentimes it's when the response to the incident seems to confirm the worst fears of the people in the affected community. For example, when a grand jury decides to not investigate or not allow a trial on some of these cases go from what can easily be explained away as individual error, or a bad seed officer, or a problem with procedures, or mitigating circumstances. There's a lot of ways to explain away any of these kinds of cases. But you can't explain away if it's the community, whatever. If the grand jury says, you know, we're not going to look into this. And grand juries look into everything. I think if you're in these communities, it fosters a belief that, look, it's a cover-up. Look, they're protecting their own. Look, another black man dies and nobody cares. I mean, listen, if that were you and you saw it over and over again, wouldn't you think so? I think a lot of people in these communities would be able to say this or that cop was bad. It's a lot harder when it looks like the whole department protects the bad cop, if that's what it is. It reminds me again of the Antonin Scalia argument about, you know, would you convict a man who tortures somebody to find out where he hid that atomic bomb? A jury has the ability to say, you know what, no. That wasn't wrong. Put a couple of black folks on the jury, too. Make sure it's an equal representative. And let the jury say that. And then if the people want to get angry, they're not angry with a cover-up. They're angry at the jury. But the problem happens when you have, like, the grand juries. Just so you know, folks, the old line about a grand jury, and you've probably seen it mentioned in news stories 100 times since the Eric Gardner incident, is that they'll indict a ham sandwich if the prosecutor wants to. And it's absolutely true. The whole grand jury system is a joke. It's been a joke for a long time. News reporters know it's a joke. They essentially work with the prosecutor. And when a prosecutor wants to move ahead with a case, the grand jury gives them the go-ahead. When the prosecutor doesn't, the grand jury doesn't. I saw a number the other day, and since I'm doing it from memory, excuse me, I don't know the time frame, and I don't know the exact numbers, but the numbers were like this. They were talking about federal grand jury indictments. Around 180,000 cases were looked at. The grand jury decided to do the thing the prosecutor didn't want them to do 11 times. That's indicting a ham sandwich. So you have every right, if you were in one of these communities and the grand jury decided not to, you know, for example, ask for a trial for that officer who choked Eric Gardner, you have to assume that's what the prosecutor wanted. And if you are suggesting that there is a relationship and the prosecutors and police officers and agencies work well together, you would be right. In other words, there's a heck of a lot of evidence that if you want to think about this as a cover-up and a conspiracy to protect your own, you could use for your argument, right? So you can see why people are angry if it looks like the state is declining to look into something. And again, if the officer didn't do anything wrong, the jury will acquit them, and that's a lot better than having, you know, the grand jury in secret working only with a prosecutor, hearing nothing from the defense. That's a lot different than that. there are officer unions in New York saying that their officers feel put upon and like they're getting the short end of the stick and bad publicity and people are think bad things of them. Well, this is why. We have to work on this, don't we? We have to work so that police officers can once again, you know, have their name cleared. Let's just make sure everything that's supposed to be happening to ensure that the system is running fairly is working. We can't not use those things and then claim it's fine. If the grand jury indicts the police officer that chokes Eric Garner and he goes to trial, boom, that's the system working, right? There's another case in Ohio. Was it Ohio, Ben? Of a 12-year-old boy who was carrying a fake gun, who was shot by officers. And I want to use this as a sort of a jumping off point. I'm looking at what's about to be a very long show, if I'm looking correctly at the timing meter here. I'll just glance down at it. To me, this is, and I want to tie the two stories together, but to me, this situation, shooting this boy with the fake gun, is a wonderful jumping off point for what I think is wrong. And I want to say at the outset that this is coming from a civilian, and there are going to be police professionals out there who will probably say, Dan, if you knew why we do what we do, you'd know how wrong you are. I leave the door open to that possibility being open. I also would like to point out that while I feel that these sorts of incidents are on the rise, they are still a minute number, you know, in relation to the whole, right? If we say that Dan Carlin thinks there's more incidents of police aggressiveness and more of a willingness to suppress a threat, even if that takes down a victim, than take any chances, we still may be talking about a 1% of, you know, the equations out there. I mean, if you say to me, Dan, look at the number of police contacts that police have every day. Now, look at the percentage where you have any of these problems. It's minute. Okay, let's play with the number 1% for a minute. And I don't think that's an unusual number. If you said only 1% of the police contacts, you know, goes south, like the kind you're talking about, Dan, if I said that that number had jumped to 2%, it's still a minute fraction. 98% of all police contacts with the public go just fine, right? But it's still a problem that's doubled in severity from 1% to 2%. So, I mean, I feel like that's where this is. But I also don't know where the line is before people have a real problem. How many of these incidents have to happen before something that is perhaps totally out of proportion to the size of the issue, 98%, Dan, of cops and contacts with public is going fine. I don't know how much in this era of videos and YouTube sharing and everything else, this has to be a problem before, like the police officers union in New York is worried about, the reputation of police officers begins to suffer. And unjustly in most cases, right? It may be perception, but perception can be reality. And I'll give you an understanding how it happens, and I'm sure police officers know this already. Go to YouTube and look at some police shootings. Nothing will affect you on the police issue as much as that. Now, I'll tell you why in a second, but it's connected to this shooting of the 12-year-old African-American boy with the fake gun in Ohio, right, Ben? I believe it was in Cleveland. Here, the story goes like this. We know about it mostly because it was caught on surveillance video. The surveillance video has no sound. The camera doesn't move. It's from this one angle. It shows this boy playing, you know, like not cops and robbers, but you know what I mean. He's got his fake gun and he's playing by a gazebo. At one point, there's one other person in the shot, but then that person leaves. So it's essentially an empty park with this kid. Now, he seems to have taken off the special orange marker that tells police and everyone else that this gun is not real. So for all intents and purposes, it looks like a kid with a gun. Straight up, it does. Then all of a sudden, you know, the police officers get the call, possible man with a gun in a park. One of the mitigating factors is that whereas the initial caller said it might be a kid, it sounds like the dispatcher did not tell the police who were rolling up on the scene that it could be a kid. So as far as they know, they've got some armed male in the park or what have you. And you can see on the surveillance that all of a sudden out of the side of the camera shot, the police car comes barreling over like the curb onto the grass over by the gazebo and screeches to a halt about a foot or two from the kid. As this is happening, it's grainy, it's hard to tell, but he appears to reach kind of into his waistband like you would for the gun. And the officer on the passenger side of the police car, who is about a foot or two from the kid, shoots him. I don't remember if it was multiple times, but kills him. Now, the police officer, I think, said that he had no choice. He didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, no time, all those kinds of things. And that is all absolutely true, right? But being the civilian that I am, so take this with a grain of salt, I look at this whole thing and say, yeah, the kid had no time and the officer had no time either. They rolled right up to him instantly and he's confronted with this reality and no time to decide. Or, in my opinion, I looked at that shooting and you can go look at it online and you look at it and you think to yourself, this 12-year-old kid did not even know what was happening. And the police officer who shot him didn't either. Was that the best way to roll up on this scene? See, in my head, and again, this is where the officers may have a huge problem with me, but I look at this like a civilian. But so many times when I go look at those videos of police encounters that end up fatally for citizens, I look at it and I say, you know, there's an old line, was this trip really necessary? You look at them and you just go, is that how this scene had to play out? Couldn't those police officers that rolled up on that kid with the fake gun, couldn't they have stopped 50 yards away? Gotten behind their cars, pulled the old bullhorn out and tell the 12-year-old to drop the gun? Now, if you're in a crowded mall and you think they're going to start opening fire on passersby, I understand if you approach that differently. This is a park with no one in it. The only person that kid could have shot, as far as I can tell from the video, is himself. And that ended up happening anyway, so I'm not sure what you were preventing. I'll give you another example. So you go online and you look at these shootings by police officers. Now, understand, you can also go look at shootings of police officers, and that's probably what's going on in these officers' mind, and you'd be less than human if it wasn't going on in your mind, too, so let's acknowledge that. But, I mean, I was watching one case, and I think there was actually a demotion in this one for somebody not following policy. But oftentimes, the most disturbing stories you hear from these police agencies are the ones where mentally ill people, usually armed with nothing more than a pointy object, get killed. There's one, as I said, I think it was in Pennsylvania, and you can go watch the video, and it shows a semicircle of police officers. I want to say about eight of them in a half-moon formation, at least one of them, maybe two of them with AR-15s, so what the media would call assault rifles. Every one of the police officers has their weapon pointed and aimed. Some of them are bracing their pistols on their hands. Everybody has their gun pointed at a human being about 20 or 30 yards away. There's a good intervening distance between the line of police and the soon-to-be victim. The victim is a mentally ill man and is armed with a penknife. At one point in the video, the man makes a move forward. I want to say like one step. It's not very perceptible. And every one of those police officers opens fire. This is a 2012 incident, I want to say, Ben. 42 shots in 2 seconds. 16 hit the man. He's killed instantly, armed with a penknife. When you look at that, you say to yourself, was this the training? And you hear this, by the way, from the agencies a lot of times, their ethics panels and whatnot, and their boards will say, well, the officers in the field were acting in accordance with their training. And so a civilian like myself says, that's what they were trained to do? Were they always trained like that? Or is that another one of these post-9/11 things? I tend to think it is, and I'll get into this in a second. If that's the training, if driving up on that black kid who was 12 years old with the fake gun so that you're a foot away and no one has any time to think, if that's your training, the civilian side of me says the training screwed up. The priorities are wrong. I'll give you another example. And to me, this shows that the priorities are not skewed enough in making sure that the victim doesn't end up being dead by the end of the encounter. This is out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And if you know anything about Albuquerque, you know their police department is under fire, pardon the pun, right now for too many shootings. And I don't know what too many shootings are, but apparently even the feds think Albuquerque's got too many of them. Last I heard, they were going to investigate. But you can go watch some of these shootings online, and they are profoundly disturbing. The one I saw involved, again, another mentally ill man and with a pointy object. It's always upsetting when knife-wielding people are killed by gun-wielding people. With distance in between them, you always think to yourself, couldn't they have backed off? In this case, it was a camper, a person who was camping out on, I want to say, like national parkland or whatever, and the police officers had surrounded him. Again, there was distance between them, and they're talking to him. So you don't know what happened before the video started. But it's one of those things where they look like they're basically saying to the guy, you have to come with us, or you have to get down, or, you know, something like that. And then when the video starts, there's a police dog, there's multiple policemen. The policemen have rifles. They have AR-15s, too. And the guy is jabbering, you know, he's mentally ill, he's nonsensical jabbering, And then I'm going to say, I don't remember exactly what he did, but I'll give the benefit of the doubt and say he made a move toward the officers, but there's intervening distance between them. And everybody with a rifle opens up on him instantly. He falls down in a heap on his stomach and doesn't move again, bleeding, the whole thing. Now, again, the civilian in me, call me crazy, but then they pull out the non-lethal stuff. Now, they've shot this guy multiple times. He has not moved since they shot him. The police officer, one of the police officers who shot him, and I hope he's off the force now, appears to say, "Booyah!" when they shoot him. I'm not the only person that thought that's what I heard in the comments underneath the story. Other people mentioned it too. I'm going to pretend I didn't hear it though, because it really doesn't matter. And all I'll notice is that after they shot him with real bullets, they pull out the beanbag rounds and they shoot him multiple times with the beanbags. The beanbags create a terrible bruise. It's meant to, you know, disperse protesters or whatnot. All I can figure is they're shooting him with the beanbags to make sure he's not faking, but he doesn't move. No reaction to the beanbags at all. Then they sick the dog on him. Now, mind you, he's bleeding to death while all this is happening. The dog runs up, bites him on the leg, you know, tears at the leg for a minute. Again, no response from the guy. So they assume, I guess, that he's no longer a threat. And then they start going around his camp. They move his hand to show that there's a little knife or something in there. So there was justification for what just happened. And then they go looking around the camp. And I'm thinking to myself when I look at the video, get an ambulance. What are you doing? Get help. To a civilian, to an observer, to someone outside the scene, it looks like there's not enough care for what just happened. If it wasn't supposed to happen, get some help. And by the way, you know, I mean, I feel bad for the police officers here, too, because in the same way that that police union in New York is saying that they feel like, you know, their record is being besmirched, do you know how much damage? I mean, I'm sure they do. When you look at that Albuquerque video, for example, of the shooting of the mentally ill guy with the knife, or you see the video, where was it, Pennsylvania, Ben, with the line of police officers shoot the mentally ill man, that is devastating. From a public relations standpoint, that is devastating and affects the police reputation totally out of proportion to how big of an event that was, right? But I mean, I don't see how it could be otherwise. Look at what's going on there. It looks like you have numerous armed with projectile weapon police officers, and then you have a mentally ill person with a little knife or something a distance away from them, and in none of those cases does it look like the police are ever in any danger. I mean, how? There's no way to spin that where it's not going to affect their reputation. And unless the police agency says, you know what, everything went wrong in that situation, that should never happen, they're going to look bad. Now, does that mean police officers have to be perfect? That's the problem. And if you're not perfect, look what can happen to you in those situations. Go to YouTube and type in, you know, police traffic stop shooting and see what happens to, you know, see the way police officers really get killed most of the time in the line of duty, in that most dangerous of situations, walking up in an unknown circumstance to a car in a traffic stop. That's when officers are really, really, really in danger. You know, if we could figure out a way to make that safer, you'll save a ton of officers' lives. There are not a lot of officers anywhere being killed by homeless, knife-wielding people that are held at gunpoint at a distance. And by the way, you show me an officer at a traffic stop, and he's going to get cut a lot of slack versus how he handles that. You know why? Because they do get killed all the time doing that. It's a tough job. We all understand this. And it's an unforgiving job. You don't get to have a lot of errors on videotape shared on Facebook, and not get police officers everywhere targeted. And again, this is why the grand jury thing, I think, is so important, because it takes it from a level where a person could say, hey, listen, you know, if they have a 1% failure rate amongst police officers, you're going to get stories like that, and turns it into, can you believe the instruments of justice in my state shut that investigation down? Big difference. And, you know, to tie these two basic stories together, it's funny, but this system that we have here, you know, one of the things I say on this program a lot, but I think you all know it, I think it's integral to a system where the public is supposed to be the decision makers, is that things have to be made public. So the reason that the grand jury denying to allow the Eric Garner case, for example, or the Ferguson case, to go to trial is to deny us all the chance to examine the evidence in an open court that's covered by the media and
come to our own conclusions. We may differ from each other. We may differ from the jury, but that's how these things get sort of emotionally worked out and where we kind of, you know, figure out where the lines are and where they've been crossed. And, you know, did the police officer do anything wrong in the Eric Garner case or not? It's only one way to find out, right? Where the public has some sort of involvement and where the issue is debated and where we hear prosecuting attorneys and defense attorneys. That's a cleansing thing. That renews the system and the confidence in it, right? When you don't get that, the opposite happens, and questions are allowed to fester, and people wonder why something was swept under the rug, and why can't we have this? And, you know, well, you can see how that goes, right? And it's the same dynamic you see in the national security question when it comes to something like torture. Folks, if Dan Carlin had his way, an admitted radical, as you know, so take it with a grain of salt, as I've said like 9 times in this program, but I mean, I would have hearings and trials, and it'd be like the Church and Pike Committee and the Rockefeller committees of the 70s all over again. We'd be revamping FISA. I mean, there'd be a lot of real changes. I think the CIA would be gone, replaced with some new agency. Long time coming, if you ask me, to fire the CIA and create. We only have like, what, 15 intelligence agencies or something, Ben? I mean, we would just be like blind, wouldn't we? I'm sorry, but the CIA, I don't know how often a government agency has to fail before you say we're scrapping this and starting over. Nonetheless, so if it were me, there'd be a lot of reforms, but we're not even going to get an agreement over whether or not the line that we so egregiously crossed was really a bad line to have crossed in the first place. That's how far, that's how I know I'm a radical. That's how far behind the curve I am. In this era of secrecy, folks, the one thing we are denied is an open airing of information and policies and practices. And because we're not allowed to know that because it would be exposing our secrets to the enemy, we can't have that cleansing, renewing experience that, you know, we could get in an open court on some of these police cases. And I bet if these things keep happening, you're going to get some. Some grand juries are going to say, oh, no, this has to go to trial. And at least in those cases, we'll be able to experience that renewing, you know, open sense of examining the evidence for ourselves, something we're not allowed to do in the realm of what's going on in the war on terror. That's why, you know, these revelations are so important when they come from whistleblowers or any of these other sources who are giving you information you're not supposed to have, because the people that say you're not supposed to have it are the ones that know you're going to probably be pissed off when you find out what's been done in your name. You might think it contradicts your values. I'm a radical for thinking that you ought to have a right to weigh in on that. I don't know how you can possibly weigh in on that if they don't even think you have a right to know about it. As I've said before, we've crossed so many of the almost national biblical lines in the sand, if you will, 10 commandments of Americanism, that the next time there's a very big attack on American soil, what won't we do? I mean, do you really think we won't torture somebody? I mean, we can't even agree now that that was the wrong thing to do. You know, if you brought my grandfather here now, he would be slack-jawed by how far we've come in a way that most of us don't even notice because we've got that old frog in the hot water scenario going on. What's this country going to be doing if we stay on the current path that's going to make me slack-jawed if I live long enough to exist in my grandchildren's world? I've been hearing a lot of good things about Ting from you folks. I mean, the other day, I don't know how much Ting will like this. I got an interesting contact from someone who said, went into Ting, they looked at my cell phone bill and ran some calculations and told me that they actually can't save me money. One of the few that applies to. And he said, it kind of makes me want to sign up with Ting anyway. Because who tells you that? Ting is a customer service company that's in the cell phone business, and we've mentioned this to you before. It's kind of why I like them. I mean, first of all, you know me. I'm not a contract guy. If you want my business, keep me happy. That's the philosophy behind Ting. There have never been any contracts, and there still aren't. In fact, Ting will help you get out of yours with whatever company you're in it with now. They'll help you by giving you a credit on your early termination fee. It's usually like 25%, but up until about January 5th, it's going to be 50%. You could save up to $175 in various credits if you decide to switch to Ting now before January 5th. Why would you want to do that? Well, because you only pay for what you use. And for most people, that's a savings. The average bill is $26.
There are no overage charges or penalties, no add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill, unlimited devices on one plan. Ben, actually, if there is a Ben, had to call the no-hold customer support the other day for a particular reason. Guess what? No hold. Ting's mobile service made easy. It's on the nationwide Sprint network. And if you get a hold of them through dancarlin.ting.com, you'll get a $25 service credit or device discount.
Want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend, and it won't cost you a penny more.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.